If you'd like you to turn, please, in starting to Isaiah 41. Isaiah 41 and verse 18. We're looking at the beginning of the millennium. I'm trying to just show you some things that, you know, you don't think about very much until you suddenly hit you that this is big. It's massive. Verse 18. Now, this is God speaking. I will open rivers in the high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia tree and the myrtle and the oil tree. I will set in the desert the fir tree and the pine and the box tree together, that they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Eternal has done this and the Holy One of Israel has created it. It's a statement of I am He to the rest of the world. How big a statement is it? Well, I think, is it Mr. Bowles mentioned? In a sermon the other day about flying over the Sahara. I've done that a few times, and yeah, almost 3 hours, flying over, you know. What he didn't mention was, if you went the other way, from east to west, it'd take you double the time, because it's 3,000 miles across, right? I laughed the other day when somebody said there was a shortage of sand, and I thought, you know what? I know where there's some. It's incredible, 3,000 miles by over 1,000 miles north-south. That's quite a long way. God says, I'm going to cover it in trees. I'm going to cover it in rivers and ponds and springs of water. Think about it. Are you being led up the garden path here? Is that the empirical we? Or I, should I say? He's not going to be, can you imagine Jesus Christ out planting trees? I can tell you who will be planting trees, so you better get used to it, folk. We've got about 20 billion trees to plant in the Sahara alone. And then there's all sorts of other deserts and scrublands around the world that will need doing. So I don't know who's going to grow all these trees. But trees make a tremendous difference. In the land of Israel, the weather is changing in some parts because of trees. They're planting trees. It used to be covered in trees. But the various wars and all that, they all get used up and for fuel and weapons and so on. But it changes the whole weather and the whole climate. But that brings us to the next part of this regeneration of an earth, which I can just remind you, I mean, you people in the Philippines have just experienced a minor earthquake of 7 or thereabouts. That's big enough for most people. Big enough for most people. But you know what? By the time we get to the end and that final earthquake strikes, every city is leveled. Continents are moved. Mountain ranges disappear. A classic example, if you look at India, you can see where India has been thrust up into Asia, and that's where the Himalayas form the amphitheater around the top, Mount Everest and all that lot. That's all going to be flattened again. Can you imagine that? 29,000 feet of rocks and stuff flattened, being brought back down. A lot more land. But can you imagine the mess the earth is going to be in? Talk about rolled over and turned over and we're going to have a blank canvas and we're going to have people. We're going to have people who've come out of the tribulation. They're not really going to be that healthy, I'd imagine. In fact, one of the one things we'll have to do is do some healing just to get them to be able to do anything. And of course, the first job they've got to do basically is clear up the land of all the bones and stuff from the various people that try to take over God's job of ruling the world. 7 months they'll be clearing the land up. 7 months. Then we start to get down to business. Have you ever thought about it? What's the most important thing in these people's lives? Really? It's soil. It's the muck that we all talk about. The soil is crucial because that's where life comes from. It's where man came from. And we live by what is developed and grown in the soil. So, you know, oh dear me, it gets you to try to work out where to start, really. If you improve the soil, you improve the yield, you improve the quality of the food, you improve the health of the nation. That's why people are unhealthy today. One of the things I want to go through today is look at some of the food we eat and to show what it should have in it, if it was in good nick. Getting people to think this way is going to be a major part of our job. Think about it. We're going to have people who are in the armies, navies, air forces, police, security, hospitals, unemployed. There's no job for them. They'll be given a piece of land and they'll have to live on it. And they're going to have to learn an awful lot. You know, the problem today, we had it yesterday. We had a lovely meal. We had a leg of lamb from New Zealand, 12,000 miles away. Why? We live in Wales where they virtually grow on trees. There's sheep everywhere. There's probably, four, five, six sheep for every human being. But we've got to import them all the way from New Zealand because of some trade agreement. We get potatoes from Morocco. We get grapes from Peru. But you know what? A lot of fresh vegetables are coming also from different countries. And one of the things that's been found that, they said that in production, if production can be done cheaper, it doesn't matter if it reduces the nutritional value of the taste. Not interested. If they can get more out of the ground, they'll put more in it. Philip and Paul have just moved into a new house. They've got some old rose trees. They only flower for 4 or 5 or 6 weeks, but you can smell them. They've got smell. You get a modern rose, they flower all summer, but they don't smell. So what's the point? That's the whole thing with the rose, is to get that lovely scent off it. A growing concern that fresh product loses nutritional value as it travels. For each day in transit, fresh products lose up to 10% of their nutritional value. So we get grapes from Spain, and they're going to be picked, bagged, boxed, taken to a depot, chucked on a whatever, train, whatever they use to take them up here. By the time we get them, they're probably a week old. Down in South Africa, we used to have grapes are a big deal. They grow everywhere. And you bought grapes, and the stalk that the grape was attached to was green. It was fresh. You had to really, if you wanted to pull a little chunk off, you had to really give it a little wrench. Most of the stuff you buy in the shops here, the stem is already dead. Well, the grapes still taste all right, but the stem is dead. Why? Well, they were probably picked a month ago. How much nutritional value is there left in that grape? Studies have also shown the nutritional content of many vegetables has decreased since the 1950s by up to 40%. You know, when I was a youngster, mum used to chop onions. And I used to get out of the kitchen because I couldn't take it. Your eyes were streaming. Not now. Chopped up some onions this morning, like an apple. Nothing. Because the customers don't like that, so they breed it out of the vegetables. What they're breeding out is nutrients that we need. Today's food pales in comparison with what our grandparents enjoyed. Flavor has been sacrificed for appearance and durability, while essential vitamins and minerals have diminished dramatically. This hidden nutrient loss carries serious implications for public health, though we are only now beginning to grasp its full impact. And of course, along with that, you get the impact on the gut. Our gut's got, how to forget, I mean, it's several kilos, isn't it, of bacteria. You don't think, you're carrying all these bugs around in you. That's what breaks the food down, takes the nutrients out of it, and squirts it into your system. You need it. You need that those bacteria. But a lot of the food we have today, doesn't help to do that. And it's become a big problem. Let's go back to Genesis 1. You see, God made man to run on food. That's what we work, that's how we survive. And he's very concerned that his children eat good food. But of course, the problem we've got is that Satan is very much aware of this as well. And he has done what he can to completely trash the food system in the world today, as we'll see as we go along. Genesis 1:11, and God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after its kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. It happened, because he said so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after its kind, and the tree yielding fruit, though the seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw it was good. It was good. Of course it was good. He made it. Verse 29, and God said, behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of the tree yielding seed, so that you'll have it for meat. And he dropped down to chapter 2 in verse 9, and again, out of the ground the Lord God made to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life also was in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, these two trees must have looked real cool, because Eve disregarded all the others and went for the one of these, didn't she? And we all know the Genesis 3 verse 6. And when the woman saw the tree was good for food, and it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave it also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. I turn to Genesis 18. We're going to see this is quite interesting here. This whole food, the Bible, it's like we had in the sermonette, the, you know, rejoicing and music. Yes, food. It starts off with a piece of fruit and it ends with a wedding feast. Think about it. The whole Bible centers around food. Even angels enjoy food. At Genesis 18, verse 1. And the Eternal appeared to him in the plains of Mamre, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men stood by him. And when he saw them, he ran to meet them and bowed himself towards the ground. Now, we're not told a few interesting bits and pieces there, but he obviously knew who this was. And he said, my Lord, I know if I have found favor in your sight, pass not away, I pray you, from your servant. Let a little water, I pray you, be fetched, and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. And I will fetch a morsel of bread and comfort your hearts. After that you will pass on, and therefore you come to your servant. And he said, right, do it, go for it. Now, that is a master of understatement. Verse 6, and Abraham hastened into the tent of Sarah and said, make ready quickly three measures of fine meal, knead it and make cakes from the hearth. And Abraham ran into the herb and to fetch a calf tender and good, and gave it to the young man, and he hasted to dress it. You know what? We've dressed a few sheep in our time. And, you know, it takes a fair old while to get it ready for the stick on the barbecue. It's a lot of work. And he took butter and milk and the calf which he had dressed and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they did eat. Now, this must have taken quite a bit of the afternoon, even if they just carved the cooked meat off the outside of the animal. Later on in Genesis 19, we have another series of people involved with angels. We have Lot, 19 verse 1, and they came unto angels of Sodom at even, and Lot sat at the gate of Sodom, and Lot, seeing them, rose up to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face towards the ground. So he knew who they were. He knew these weren't men. These were special. These were angels, angelic beings. And he said, now behold, my lords, turn in, I pray you, into your servant's house, and tarry all night, and wash your feet, and you can rise early and go on your way. And he said, no, we'll abide in the street tonight. They didn't want to put him out. And he pressed upon them greatly, and they turned unto him and entered into his house, and he made them a feast. Boom. And he baked them unleavened bread, and they did eat. You can go on a little bit further, food. Genesis 25, Esau. Esau. This is one of the worst things probably that ever happened in history, as far as peoples are concerned. Despised his birthright. He said, I'm about to die. What good's a birthright to me? And in verse 34, and Jacob gave Esau bread of pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink, and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. And then to add insult to injury, the birthright went the other way, accompanied by some venison stew. Again, food. Oh, yeah. And you come to the Passover. What are we talking about? We're talking about a lamb. We're talking about unleavened bread. Again, food. It's all food, food related, all the way through the Bible. Now, let's have a look at the diet. This is where it gets a little bit interesting. We start looking at what we eat today and what they ate back then. Right, even in Egypt, the Israelites actually enjoyed a pretty healthy diet, in actual fact. Numbers 11. Turn to Numbers 11. I should really read this with a real whinge in my voice, because boy, were they good at whinging. Numbers 11, verse 5. We remember the fish, which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers, and the melons, and the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Notice, these are all crops that you plant, you grow, you eat, and they're gone. Nothing permanent. You've got to replant every year, and so on. So we'll look at the foods listed for the children of Israel when they went into the promised land, and we'll see the difference. But first, the food of Egypt, six items. Interestingly, the number of man. First of all, fish. Back in ancient Israel, it seems they even farmed fish. And we think there's nothing new under the sun. Let's make a note of Isaiah 8:19, verse 10. And it says, they should be broken in their purposes. It's talking about a bit of a curse here, in actual fact. All they that make sluices and ponds for fish. So, you know, if you've got an area where you've got some decent water, you can have your fish. Fish is low-fat, high-quality protein. It's filled with omega-3 fatty acids and vitamins such as D and B2, riboflavin. Fish is rich in calcium and phosphorus and a great source of minerals such as iron, zinc, iodine, magnesium, and potassium. The American Heart Association recommends eating fish at least 2 times a week. It's a small problem in America with that, of course, because there's a lot of people don't live anywhere near the sea. Fish is packed with protein and vitamins and nutrients that can lower blood pressure and help reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke. One of the biggest problems today in our world is these very things, heart attacks and stroke, due to high blood pressure. Eating fish is an important source of omega-3 fatty acids. These essential nutrients keep our heart and brain healthy. Some good choices are salmon, trout, sardines, herrings, and mackerel. If you want to get a salmon these days, so you've got to take out a mortgage because it's so expensive. Let's move on to the millennium. Fish will be an important part of the diet in the millennium. Turn to Ezekiel 47. Ezekiel 47. And verse 9. This is when the water goes out from the center of Jerusalem under where Christ's throne will be. And this water is it's special. It shall come to pass that everything, verse 9, everything that lives, which moves, whithersoever the river shall come, shall live. So this is life-giving water in the true sense of the word. And there shall be a very great multitude of fish, because these waters come thither, for they shall be healed, and everything shall live whithersoever the river cometh. And then in verse 10, just to add the emphasis to it, and it shall come to pass that fishers shall stand upon it from Engedi to Eneglium. Now those two places are on the banks of the Dead Sea. Believe me, you ain't going to fish down there these days. That water is so, so salty. I think we've seen, you know, people with students went down there and they were just floating around, bobbing under. You can't get under it. It's almost like it's thick. A place to spread forth nets. Their fish shall be according to their kinds, as the fish of the great sea, exceeding many. Again, exceeding many. Emphasized. Now, that's salt water fish. So you have your cod and all that sort of stuff. That's what they'll have. But the miry places thereof and the marshes thereof shall not be healed. They shall be given to salt. So it would seem at the one end, there's going to be a marshy, boggy area where the salt seems to collect. But the rest of the water's, good for fish. Now we come to cucumbers. Quite fascinating because I know a few people who've had problems with since COVID that they can't smell and they can't taste. You can smell cucumber a mile away. Yeah. Why? It's not a strong smell. It's certainly not a strong taste. I made my wife a curry, and I tell you, I really laid into it. I mean, this stuff was bending the spoon just about. It was so hot. Taste it. Couldn't taste it. And yes, you can taste cucumber. But you know, they're a lot more important than we tend to think. Cucumbers are made of 96% water, but because more than half of the body is made of water, it's essential for normal functioning of different systems. And it goes into vitamin A. They're loaded with vitamin A. This vitamin serves as one of the many antioxidants that protect the body from free radicals, lowering the risk of various cancers and illness due to damaged cells. You know, your body is constantly replacing cells. Vitamin A has many important functions, such as aiding in normal bone growth, developing blood, white blood cells, and normal blood cell functioning. And vitamin A is also crucial for the retina and good vision. So it's just cucumber. How often do you eat cucumber? It's got vitamin K. Plays a role in building bone as well as other tissues in the body. You know, we're short of this. We've a family member who stepped off a boat onto the quay and shattered a leg in 10 places. We saw an x-ray and it looked like somebody had gone to work on it with a Meccano set. Big bits of metal and screws and bolts and things all the way up from her ankle to 10 different places it was broken. And this is because, basically, it's a dietary, and it's also hereditary, I think, as well, somewhere. But we don't see who else was in the line. It talks about coagulating blood. Then it mentions about potassium. 100-gram serving, around 3.5 ounces of cucumber, contains around 150 milligrams of potassium. And that aids in metabolic functions and also plays a role in the development of muscle tissue. Adequate potassium is also necessary for maintaining normal electrical activity of the heart. Cucumbers also contain other beneficial minerals such as calcium, phosphorus, and magnesium. I'm going through these for a reason. I want to show you how complex our food is that we eat. Sorry, correct that. How complex our food should be that we eat. And it's not. And that's where the problem comes in. Melons. This is another one of the foods that are mentioned. Watermelons are an excellent source of several vitamins, including vitamin A and C and so on. It says tomatoes have been highly touted. That's a great source for lycopene, a powerful antioxidant, which helps fight heart disease and several types of cancer, including prostate cancer in particular. Watermelon, however, has the highest concentration of lycopene of any fresh fruit or vegetable. Watermelon. You know, you take watermelon, it's tasteless, isn't it? There's very little taste in it, really. It's nice, not only if it's ice cold, and it's got a nice and sweet, the very delicate taste. Look what's in it. And it's the other gold mine, evidently, with it. It was just saying it's very good for you because it fills you up. And there's not any, very, very few calories in it. So it's a less fattening center. They talk about the other benefits of melons, basically. For one, you skin benefits greatly from the minerals and the vitamins. Your body also appreciates the fact that you are consuming melons because they help to flush out toxins, which cause digestive issues, breathing difficulties, and nerve disruptions. Now, see, I may have made a slight mistake in my notes here. These are the vegetables and fruits that they're actually having in Egypt. We haven't got to the new Israel, the land of milk and honey, which is a different story. It says melons deliver more nutrients per calorie because of their high water content helps to transport these nutrients to your cells. Some of the most common melons are watermelon, cantaloupes, and all the rest of it. Leeks. How many people eat leeks? A lot of people do. A lot of people won't touch them. I've heard people say, oh, slimy. Leeks are vital. Leeks are a rich source of vitamin A. 100 grams contain approximately 33% of your daily recommended total. That's nothing. 100 grams is, put one end of a leek. It says it functions by maintaining the integrity of the health of the muscular lining of your nose, throat, urinary tract, and digestive tract. And also plays a part in white blood cells. Antibacterial properties. Leeks have antibacterial properties. Although not as potent as their cousin garlic, leeks contain a compound called alanase. When the leeks are cut, alanase reacts with oxygen to form a sulfur compound called allicin. Allicin's antibacterial effectiveness was successfully tested against Staphylococcus in 2004 study in the British Medical Journal. It was found effective against E. coli. And the one example they gave, this guy was on antibiotics, and he was on, I think he did three courses, and the courses were costing over £1,000 a go. Several injections in a course. And at the end of it, he still had the problem. He went on to the Allicin, and within a month, he's back to normal. Garlic. I believe, from what I remember reading when I was at college, and this is a little while ago, that the slaves, as they were called, they weren't slaves, the people who were building the pyramids, part of their wages was a complete clove of garlic, a complete bowl. And they had to eat that every day to maintain their health. Oh. And it says, Allicin is inactivated by heat. So it says, if you're going to use your leeks, cut them and let them stand for about 10 minutes before cooking them to get the maximum benefit of the Allicin. And again, they promote the growth of a healthy gut bacteria. Oh, there's a little leek just lying in your garden there. Fluid retention or edema is the swelling or accumulation of excess fluid in the interstitial spaces between your cells or in your circulatory system. Accumulation is usually most noticeable in the feet and ankles, fingers and face. Leeks have got a profound effect on it. But of course, the doctor's not going to tell you that. He's got a pill. And the pharmaceutical company makes a fortune selling the pills. Being a high source of vitamins and minerals, the vegetable plays an important part in providing defense against a number of ailments and diseases. It also protects optimal health and strengthens the immune system of the body. Some other major benefits are given below, and then it goes on and on and on. Just from leeks. Seems to have an amazing effect on biological functions like digestion and metabolism. As I say, these things contain all sorts, minute quantities. But that's how we work. We get little bits of everything. The body replaces the... I don't know how they work this out, mind you, but they say that within a 7-year period, virtually every cell in your body has been replaced. Should have been replaced. Yeah. the other thing they do is they act as an antiseptic in the fight against infection and contamination. You know, interesting to note that three of the vegetables listed are in the allium family. This is garlic, onions, and leeks. These must be an important part of our diet. As I say, the old Israelites, they complained and moaned and groaned, but they didn't do too bad. They really didn't do too bad. And then, of course, you have onions. Dry onions are a surprising source of fiber and a rich source of healthy sulfur compounds, similar to those found in garlic. Onions also contain... you can't pronounce half these words. It's a mile and a half long chemicals called flavonoids, which help vitamin C in its function, improving the integrity of blood vessels and decreasing inflammation. Inflammation is the big enemy, as we'll come to in a minute. All this spells help for your cardiovascular system. In addition, a newly identified compound appears to rival the prescription drug Fosamax in inhibiting bone loss in menopausal women. Onions also contain vitamin C, chromium. Chromium is a mineral that helps cells respond to insulin. There's a bit of a problem today, isn't there? Ultimately, assisting with blood glucose control. And that's what so many people need today, because we're out of control. I've been there, done that, and I got the T-shirt. And got back out of it. You can. You can stop it. You can kill it dead in your tracks. But you've got to know what to eat. That's the key. Food is actually medicine in a way. And that's why it's so important. Garlic has often been described as miracle food. Now modern science is finding that when it comes to the strongest, when the strongest antibiotics fail to treat MRSA, for instance, allicin, a chemical found in garlic, does the job. And it does it in animals as well. People give it to the animals. Its antibacterial and antiviral properties are now being investigated by the drug companies. You betcha, you know what they're doing? They'll do what the guy did. You know aspirin? Everybody has aspirin, right? Do you know it's a natural thing? You get it by, is it the bark or is it it's a tree? The old Indians used to use it in America. This chemist got hold of it and he thought, aha, that does work. So what he did was he isolated all the stuff in it and took one component out and claimed it was a new invention. The bit he took out was the bit that stopped inflammation. Boom. Did I say any more? Previous ages, garlic was an integral part of people's diet. They knew it kept them healthy. Oh yeah, I must mention this. When I started work, I was a draftsman, junior draftsman. We had 120 draftsmen in this huge drawing office. My mentor, who was a real character, had just escaped. You might remember this is 1960, which is just after the crisis in Hungary when the Russians went in and beat them up and a whole lot of Hungarians left. And this was one of them. He's a terrific man. He knew his job as well. He's really good. He had one problem. Every day he'd come to work with a whole garlic. Complete the whole thing. And he'd sit there and he'd peel the outside shell off and munch away like an apple all day. You could smell this guy coming. If you were walking on the corridor and he was coming there, you could smell him before he got to you, right? But you know what? The whole drawing office got sick, apart from the three of us that worked around this man. You wrote that out. Garlic. Let's go to the diet in Canaan. This is really when it gets a bit more interesting, too. Deuteronomy 8, verse 8, you need to make a note. A land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates. A land of olive oil and honey. Do you see the difference? This is not transitory stuff. This isn't the stuff you plant every year and it disappears when you eat it. It's a lot more, you know, vines, permanent, fig trees, pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey. Now, you come to the first thing we'll look at is wheat. The whole grain is a concentrated source of vitamins, minerals, and protein. Correction, the whole grain should be a concentrated source of vitamins, minerals, and protein when the refined grain is mostly starch, which is what most people eat. Wheat grain is a staple food used to make flour for leavened flat and steamed breads, biscuits, cookies, cakes, breakfast cereal, pasta, noodles. This goes on and on. But wheat is a prime example of the problem we face today. The wheat in our daily bread today is not the same wheat as it was a little over 50 years ago. I remember as kids we used to play in the wheat fields, and all you had to do was slightly crouch down and nobody could see you. Because stuff is 4 foot high. It's beautiful. And every now and again you'd bump into a flock of sparrows, hundreds of them, and they'd just rise up like a swarm as you ran through them. Oh, it was lovely, good fun. Today, the wheat we have is a hybrid that attains only half the height of those old film and photo scenes showing the amber waves of grain. It's less than 2 feet high, right? Why? Well, it uses less chemicals to grow, but it's better than that. Wheat has been genetically morphed into a high glycemic index GI food that spikes your blood sugar as bad or worse than sugar. Wheat. Bread, which is what people tend to live on. Even worse than its high GI is the fact that those wheat kernels and other grains contain a type of protein called gluten. It's a sticky sort of protein that's useful for binding. Yeah, it appears that the old wheat was 3% gluten. It is now, how much do you reckon? How much do you think it is today? 50% gluten. Can you see a slight problem there? Because the gluten causes inflammation, doesn't it? Yeah. What happens if we eat gluten? Husband gets out of the house quick because it's not safe to be there. Shame. It is. It's absolutely horrendous. The hybrid was created to make better textured breads and pastries and produce a higher crop yield. But it's even worse than that. Because the higher crop yield was actually a lower quality wheat. So you start adding all these things through, and your daily bread is the last thing you should be eating. Just as the gluten content of wheat increased, a new method of making bread on an industrial scale occurred, called the Chorleywood bread process. It's a method of efficient dough production to make yeasted bread quickly, producing a soft, fluffy loaf, which, if you keep it reasonably cool, will last for about a month. In fact, at the end of a month, you can still feed it to the birds. It's not dried out. It's still soft and fluffy. Compared to traditional bread making process, CBP, as they call it, uses more yeast, various food additives, and high-speed mixing to allow the dough to be made from lower protein wheat and produces bread in a shorter time. Another problem, this process uses three times as much yeast as traditional bread. A lot of that yeast is in still the bread, and that gives you, Candida, that's the one, thank you. Candida. Major problem today with people. So we see a huge increase in gluten, three times as much yeast, poorer quality wheat. What should be the basis of our daily bread is a total unmitigated disaster. We have a bread maker. We've had a bread maker now for 20-odd years. And we use flour, sugar, a whole teaspoon of sugar, and a whole teaspoon of salt. We use some water, we use a little bit of olive oil, and we press button B, and 2 hours later a lovely loaf of bread comes out. And the flour we get from a mill where it's actually stone ground, which means it's cold, it's kept cold. Most of the flour you buy is hot milled. It drops down a thing with blades and stuff and to cut it, and it gets hot. It destroys a lot of the content, the good stuff, in the actual wheat. I know Philip told us, he had a guy at work come one day, nicked one of his sandwiches. He was just hungry, so he gave one of his sandwiches. And his first comment was, "Oh, bread's great, man. Where do you get our bread from?" He said, "I'm a bread maker." "Oh, okay." got a bread maker. Saw him a few weeks later. How's it going with the bread maker? Oh, I sent it back. Why? Bread didn't last 3 days. What did Mr. Armstrong say? Eat food that goes off and eat it before it does. Why? Because that's got life in it. The stuff that lasts more than that is dead. It's a chemical compound. Oh, dear me. Our daily bread. Then they had barley. Barley is a major cereal grain. Important uses as animal fodder, as a source of fermented material for beer and certain distilled beverages. Without barley, there would be no Guinness. That's serious. As a compound for various health foods, it's used in soups and stews and barley bread of various cultures. Barley grains are commonly made into malt in a tradition and ancient method of preparation. But again, it's a basic type of thing. We come to vines. Not much to say about vines. I mean, let's be honest. What grapes? So grapes can be eaten raw. They can be used for making jam, juice, jelly, wine, grapeseed extract, raisins, vinegar, and grapeseed oil. Very, very useful. We were blessed in one house we had in South Africa. We had 7 vines. This is when I was a youngster. And 7 vines all up on a frame. And the first one was an early grape. The last one was one that was harvested literally as the frost was coming in the winter. And we had grapes for 6-7 months. And you go out in the morning with a dew on them and pick them. And you know something? You don't get grapes like that in the shop. We had a Victoria plum tree. Have you ever had a plum straight off a tree? Yeah, it's different. It's completely different to the stuff you get in the shop. Because the one that's in the shop was picked before it was ripe. It got ripe in a box somewhere, which is not quite how it was designed to be ripened. We were lucky in one garden to have a big mango tree. Our kids were constantly sticky. You cannot eat a mango and stay tidily clean. You end up in a mess, yeah. But seriously, when you get things off a tree, oh, it's a joy, absolute joy. You walk out in the garden and pick a couple of pea pods and take the peas out. They're sweet. They're just yummy. I tried growing beans one time, but never got any in the house. The kids ate them all on the vine. But there is one story about grapes that makes me really, oh, I wish. Numbers 13:23. This is when the spies went into the land and they came back. And they came into the brook of Eshcol and cut down from thence a branch with one cluster of grapes. And they bare it in between two upon a staff. The bunch of grapes was so big and so heavy, they had to tie it to a staff and carry it between two men on their shoulders. Now, I want some grapes like that. I think Mr. Monroe would like some grapes like that to make his wine as well. Seriously, yeah. So, that's a Gentile area. That's not people farming according to God's law. And look what they were doing. And, of course, we have this traditional Micah 4:4. They're kind of a sign of peace and prosperity, grapes. And they shall every man sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Eternal of Hosts has spoken it. That's what people will actually have. And a fig tree, again, we had a fig tree down there. It was nearly 30 foot high, laden with figs. And unfortunately, also laden with every wasp in the local area. They love them. They're so sweet. And yeah. It said the fruit can be eaten ripe or dried and used until the next crop is ready. Now, you dry them and they last all the way through the winter until the new ones are on the tree. So you've got figs the whole year round. Isn't that brilliant? The only thing is they don't store well. They don't travel very well. So if you get fresh figs, they not travel very far because they just fall apart. It's very similar to a thing called a guava, which most of you may not even know about. Agrava is a fruit with a pinkish tinged flesh, and it's absolutely beautiful. But again, you pull them off the vine, and within hours they start going belly up in the bin. The ripe fruit does not transport well, and once picked does not keep well, but they're highly beneficial again to diet. And we come to pomegranates. Now, pomegranates, both my wife and I had this as kids. Growing up, one of the big treats was your mum got a pomegranate from the shop, if she could find one, and cut it in half, and you got half a pomegranate and a pin. And you sat on the back doorstep, spiking the little pinky bits out of them. Kept you quiet for about 2 or 3 hours, and you ended up covered in sweet juice. They use them to make grenadine syrup. That's using for in cocktails. Dried seed can be used in several culinary applications, such as granola bars, or as a topping for salad, yogurt, or ice cream. So you have get a granola bar. Chances are, if you check the ingredients, you'll see that there's actually pomegranate seeds in it. Consumption of pomegranate juice for 2 weeks was shown to reduce systolic blood pressure. It can be effective in reducing heart disease risk factors. Lots of research is actually ongoing in that area. It says pomegranate juice has been celebrated for centuries as a powerful and nutritious drink. Packed with vitamins, antioxidants, and unique compounds, it offers a range of health benefits that can positively impact your body. What's really interesting is there's more to it than this, because if you go back in the Bible, you make a note, you can check it later if you would like to, Exodus 28:33, the priest's robes had little gold bells all the way around the hem. And in between each gold bell was a gold pomegranate. And then the other thing, I gave a sermon on this quite some years ago now. The two columns, Boaz and Jacob, outside the temple, there was over 400 pomegranates all around that and the piece across the top. Right? Why? Why pomegranates? It's unusual. There's something there we're not getting, I guess. Maybe somebody can study pomegranates. We want some to study. Olive trees. Olive trees are hardy, drought, disease, and fire resistant, and can live to a great age. They can live for more than 1,000 years. The olive tree has been cultivated for olive oil, fine wood, olive leaf, and the olive fruit. It should be an important part of our diet. But you know what? In Europe, they're dying off. They're dying off. Just a few years ago, you could buy a litre of olive oil for £3.50, £4. Just recently, was it £18 you pay for that oil? It's come back down a bit. But yeah, the price has gone through the roof because the trees are dying. Why are they dying? Who knows? Honey. Honey has a long history of human consumption, and it's used in various foods and beverages as a sweetener and flavoring. It's used as an ointment for rashes and burns and to help soothe sore throats. It's also very good in a hot toddy. Historically, honey has been used by humans to treat a variety of ailments, from gastric disturbances to ulcers, wounds and burns, through ingestion or topical application, but only recently has the antiseptic and antibacterial properties of the honey been chemically explained. Different honeys have different properties, which we've known since ancient times. When honey is used topically, for example on a wound dressing, hydrogen peroxide is produced by dilution of the honey with body fluids. As a result, hydrogen peroxide is released slowly and acts as an antiseptic. Sheila's mum got an ulcer on her leg, and for the best part of 12 months, where the nurse come in every day and dress it, and nothing ever happened. It was just the same. It was just there looking horrible and ugly and everything. And I think we went to the feast, and I thought, you know what, we're going to try this. And I got a £40 I think I paid for it, a jar of top quality Manuka honey, and smear that on every day, put that on, and she went home and she had no ulcer. And we told the nurse and she just shrugged her shoulders and said, no. I had a problem with that. I got the pre-diabetics. This is the warning signs, but I had a couple of ulcers on my leg. And again, they tried everything with it. It wouldn't go. Put the honey on, within a week, it started to heal over. So, amazing stuff. Now, God promises to Israel, Exodus 3, verse 8. Exodus 3 verse 8, I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land into a good land with an enlarge, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of all the Ites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Down in verse 17, the same chapter, and he says, and I have said, and I'm telling you again so you get it, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites unto a land flowing with milk and honey. I mean, the bunches of grapes that it's going to take two of you to carry around. Yeah, and just think what you could have then done with that soil and been maintaining it and working it as God would have us do it. But of course, all this did was a big problem, didn't it? Deuteronomy 31. For when I shall have brought them unto the land which I swear unto their fathers, that flow of the milk and honey, and they shall have eaten and filled themselves and waxen fat, then will they turn unto other gods and serve them and provoke me and break my covenant, which is exactly what happened. It's so sad, right throughout the Old Testament, but there was no Holy Spirit. And without the Holy Spirit, it don't work. It's that simple. You get the situation where big companies will buy up the land. They'll buy out the farmers. What they did in South Africa was quite interesting. One of the big food companies, they'd go to a farmer and say, right, a sugar farmer, okay, how much do you produce a year? 300 tons. We'll buy 100 tons off you at market price. No problem. Next year, the guy phones up and says, well, 200 tons, that's good stuff. Market price. Next year, we'll take the whole lot, mate. 300, yeah. The next year, we need to discuss the price. Bottom of the story is, guy held, sold his farm to them, and went off into the sunset. Couldn't make a living. And that's what they were doing. That's what's happening in America with people like Mr. Gates. Buying up land. You buy up land, you strangle it. You know, nobody else can use it. So, yeah, it's all based on one little word, and it's called greed. Absolute greed. And again, they look at the land and they say, we chuck more of that fertilizer on, use this quality seed. And this is the whole thing with genetic engineering and hybrid seeds. You've got to buy them every year from the seed company. In a millennium, you know what you'll do? You'll get people, they'll grow a row of carrots. And at the end of the row, there'll be one carrot or two carrots that are left to bolt. And they flower and they produce seed. You collect that seed, that's your crop for the following year. And most vegetables do that. That's how you get your seeds. But of course, the seed company don't make any money out of that. And also, too, if you are feeding the soil properly and getting the right kind of nutrients into your thing, you're going to get top quality seeds. Hence, yeah, do well. Right. Jesus Christ enjoyed food. Some people don't seem to believe this. I don't know why. Luke 7, verse 33. You see, there is a thing today in the world that this God that they all talk about is a miserable old codger who is trying to trip you up and make your life as miserable as possible. But what did we hear in the sermonette? And I've got it in my notes here as a matter of interest. He says, rejoice. You're here to rejoice. There's a very important reason why we're here to rejoice. But we're here to rejoice. And one of the biggest ways of rejoicing is food. How much nicer, that lovely meal we had the other day there. And we all sat in there and we were waited on hand and foot. And I said to the young lady serving, I said, you know, you guys are so good. You ought to take this up professionally. And she had a little giggle. But it was just lovely to have that kind of thing and get the conversations going. And yeah, it makes the world go round. Jesus Christ knew this. Luke 7:33. John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and you said, he has a devil. The Son of Man is come, eating and drinking. And you say, behold, a gluttonous man and a wine bibber, a friend of publicans and sinners. And you know what? The first miracle that we have recorded, he made gallons and gallons and gallons of wine. Woo! Horrible! It was the prohibition. Christ wanted people to enjoy the wedding feast, so he made more wine. Unfortunately, he made it to his exacting standards, and the person running the whole show said, why have you saved the best to the last? Normally you give them the best stuff first. You know, if you give people champagne, and I've seen this done, right? You give people champagne, top quality champagne, and they quaff a couple of glasses of that. After that, you give them cider. They can't tell the difference. After he was resurrected, he made a point, Luke 24. As I say, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall if some of this, when he just suddenly appeared in a locked room and said, shalom. And you can imagine that everything would have gone rather quiet. Very quiet. And when he had thus spoken, he showed them his hands and his feet. Now, you can't mistake that, because his hands would have had a great big hole through the wrist, I think it was, or somewhere in that area, and the feet also. And of course, there was a small matter of a huge wound on his side. And when he had spoken, and while they yet believed not for joy and wondered, he said to them, "Have you got any meat, any food?" And they gave him a piece of broiled fish, baked fish, and a honeycomb. And he took it and he ate it in front of them. And that's interesting. So spirit beings can eat. Hey, hey. Good idea, because we have a wedding feast. It would be a bit of a dumb feast without any food, wouldn't it? Christ cared for people, and he understood they needed food. Isn't it? Matthew 14. Matthew 14, verse 15. And when it was evening, his disciples came to him, saying, This is a desert place, and the time is now past. Waitrose is closed, you know. Send the multitude away, they may go into the villages and buy themselves victuals. And Jesus said, they need not depart. Give them to eat, feed them. And this was kind of like, hello, we've only got 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And we've got thousands of people. And he said, bring them out. He blessed them. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the grass, and took the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to his disciples. And the disciples went out to the multitude. And they did all eat and were filled, and they took up the fragments that remained, 12 baskets full. And this definitely happened a couple of times, because the mats left over and everything were different. The other thing, of course, with Christ, and I think you can understand it, he was invited to dinner. He was very, the guests they all wanted, all the Pharisees wanted him round to their place for dinner so they could trip him up. And there's so many places in the New Testament where you go into this, and you can see they're trying their best to trip him up. One of them is Luke 7, verse 36. In the relaxed atmosphere of a feast, they thought they could catch him out on some point of the law, you see. Ah, well, he said this, you know. Verse 36, and one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house and sat down to meat. Here we go, we've got him now. Oh, yeah. Verse 37, and behold, a woman of the city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat at the Pharisee's house, brought in an alabaster box of ointment. And the rest of the story, I think you're probably very familiar with. She washed his feet, she anointed him with the thing, and then he very quietly said to the thing, to the Pharisee, I came here, you didn't wash my feet, you offered me no water to wash my feet, which was a big thing back then. She washed my feet with her tears. And he goes all the way through. And in the end, the poor Pharisee was probably praying that the floorboards would just open up and he could just quietly slip away. Luke 14. Or so many of these, you could do dozens of examples, literally. Luke 14. It came to pass, verse 1, as he went into the house of one of the chief Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath day, that they watched him. That's actually quite interesting. Makes you wonder if it was actually Nicodemus. In verse 2, and behold, there was a certain man before him which had dropsy, which is basically edema. His body was all literally puffed up with huge amounts of excess water. And Jesus answers, spoken to the lawyers and the Pharisees, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? Okay. You guys think you've set a trap for me. Now I'm going to turn it around. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? And they held their peace. And he took him and healed him and let him go, and answered then to them, saying, which of you shall have an ass or an ox fall into a pit and will not straightway pull him out on the Sabbath day? See, it's what we had in the one sermon the other day. Quoted scripture. Yeah, it was a sermon Mr. Bowles gave on the judging. Yeah. Answer it out of God's law. You can't leave an ox in the ditch. It's quite permissible to help. Now, of course, over the years, I've heard of a few people doing things on the Sabbath and claiming it was an ox in the ditch. So here again, we've got to learn to be righteous judges, maybe? make sure that what we're doing is a genuine ox in the ditch. Mark 14. This is a scripture that a lot of people don't like. A lot of people that have a thing about alcohol. Mark 14, verse 25. Verily I say to you, I will drink no more of the fruit of the vine until the day that I drink it new in the kingdom of God. That is wine. There's no question about the Greek language there. Yeah. So we're going to drink wine with Christ. Christ likes wine. Let's look at the marriage supper of the Lamb. When we are made immortal and become part of the God family, one of the first things we do is eat. Think about it. And what a wedding feast that's going to be. Revelation 19, verse 6. Revelation 19, verse 6. And I heard, as it were, the voice of a great multitude and the voice of many waters, as the voice of mighty thunderings, saying, Alleluia, for the Lord God omnipotent reigneth. Let us be glad and rejoice. There's that word again, rejoice. Why? Give honor unto him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife has made herself ready. We're at that wedding feast, and Christ's there, and we've got this huge spread in front of us. and you know what you are, you know you've made it, you're going to rejoice. I'll bet you are. I'll bet we will. I think there could be no, I can't think of a happier occasion, really. And it is granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white, for the fine linen is the righteousness of the saints. And he said to me, write, blessed are they which are called unto the marriage supper, or the feast, of all of the Lamb. And he said, these are the true sayings of God. You see, that statement there is very important. You need to put that there. He's emphasizing the fact that, I'm not joking, folks, this is fair dinkum, as they say down in Australia. This is the real thing. There is one thing, and this is where you've got to keep your ears open, right? Trying to get something different out of every sermon. Mr. Cookett Jr. made a comment, and it might have gone over your head. I hope it didn't, but it did mine at first, about AI and there being one language. Right? When did that happen before? It happened before in Genesis. What happened? God took the gloves off and went in fighting. Boom. Scrambled their language, scattered them all over the earth. We're at that point now. Think about it. How much time we got left? Just a small point. It just rattled my cage a little bit when I thought about it. You know, is this a casual comment? You think, well, hang on. If we're at that point and we're back to where we can actually now communicate with anybody anywhere, it's a bit concerning. Jeremiah 31 verse 10. When the captives return to the land, right, there's celebrations. Jeremiah 31 verse 10. Hear the word of the Eternal, O ye nations, and declare it in the isles afar off, and say, he that scattered Israel will gather him and keep him as a shepherd does his flock. For the Lord has redeemed Jacob and ransomed him from the hand of him that was stronger than he. Therefore, they shall come and sing, tying in with the sermonette, sing in the height of Zion. And Zion, of course, is that's. And they shall flow together to the goodness of the Eternal, and the wheat for the wine, for the oil, and for the young of the flock and of the herd. And their soul shall be as a watered garden, and they shall not sorrow any more at all. That's what we're looking forward to. That's one of the reasons we're here. And for us today, turn to Deuteronomy 14. This harsh, hard, unforgiving God that everybody talks about. See what he says? Verse 22 of Deuteronomy 14. Thou shalt truly tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year and year, and you shall eat therefore before the Lord your God in the place that he shall choose to place his name there. And the tithe of the corn and the wine and the oil and the first things of the herd and the flocks, you may learn to fear the Eternal, thy God, always. So it's all tied up with this deep, deep, deep reverence and obedience to God. And if the way be too long, you're not able to carry it, or if the place be too far from you, you change it into money, and you bind that money in your hand, and you go to where the Lord should choose. Verse 26. You shall bestow that money for whatsoever your heart lusts after, for oxen, for sheep, for wine, for strong drink, or for whatsoever your soul desires. And there you shall eat therefore before the Eternal your God, and you shall rejoice with your household. Why? Why should we rejoice? Oh, it's very nice having a nice big pile of lamb, that big leg of lamb. It was a cracking leg of lamb. It really was nice. Yeah, we rejoiced. Yeah, it was good. But note, it's not a suggestion. These are commands. Not suggestions. You shall bestow that money. You'll spend that money on these things. You shall eat. You shall rejoice. God wants his people to be happy and enjoy themselves and have a good time and look forward to the fulfillment of these days. And that's the key. Any good parent wants to see his kids happy. You don't like it when the kids are, you know, down and down in the mouth. This enjoyment points to a time when the people will have access to good food and good health. That's going to be our job. Our job is going to be help these people. They'll all be given a plot of land. I don't know how big it'll be. I don't know, 5 acres, 10 acres, 20 acres, whatever. And we've got to then explain to them, now, this soil is your life. This soil is your life. We'll have to give them seed, because all the seed we've got today has all been perverted. All of it. There's virtually nothing out there that's natural anymore. There's certainly no grapevines that dish out big bunches of grapes like that. There's a whole load of stuff that needs to be done. Our animals have been perverted. They've been, you know, interbred and all the rest of it. And of course now we've got the GM stuff, which is a completely another new situation. When we see the problems of today's world, and we've got to then say to these people, you were living in a fool's paradise. You thought you were on a good diet. You were eating garbage, people. You were eating absolute garbage. I wouldn't feed this stuff today to my pig. Seriously. And yes, they will have pigs. You know what pigs are good for? If you've got some land and it's a bit of a mess, it's got brambles and all that, and nettles and stuff that you really don't want to get into. Well, of course, we won't have that in the millennium so much, but the people, they go in and they eat everything, roots the lot, everything goes, and they leave it all churned up, ready for planting. But it can be quite useful. The only trouble is you can't eat them. Who'd want to anyway? We are in the business, or we will be in the business of fulfilling what Christ said. I'll come to give you life, and life more abundantly. And this time, because they have the Spirit poured out on them, they won't start going after other gods. They won't, because if they start any nonsense, they will hear a voice behind them. That's what we're here for. We're here to keep people on the straight and narrow so that they too can enter the God family. Because this whole time now is to get the earth ready for the people that come up in the resurrection. If you think about it, how many will there be? Various estimates, 70 billion, 80 billion. Not a problem. We only use about 10% of the earth to live on at the moment. I mean, look at the Sahara Desert for starters. How many people could you plug in there to give them a 10-acre plot? I mean, it would make a dent in it. And there's so many places on the earth that are like that. So they're resurrected, and there's accommodation for them. There's food for them. There'll be crops in the field. There'll be fruit on the trees. And they're going to wake up, and the last thing they knew was the sword going through them or a bullet blowing their head off or whatever. Because most people have died violently. Dying in bed today is not all that common up until this period of time. You look at the people that died during the war. We all go on about 700,000 people died in England. Yes, about 1.8 million people died of the flu that followed. When we talk about them, they're not the glorious dead. You know, it's amazing how we hold one lot of figures up as an example and then get completely shot down by something else. You go through periods of time when the population of this country shrunk dramatically. The Black Death, with 10% survival rate. We went up to she either took me to a church in a little place called Eam, up in near Manchester area, and there's a whole graveyard and it's little children gravestones, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens, age two, age three, age one, Black Death. So what? We have, let's say, 100 million people. There's enough enough land at the moment to give everybody a 5-acre plot. Do you know that? That's now. And there's going to be a lot more land because we know that from you know, you can't squash the Himalayan mountains down without stretching them out a little bit. And also the Rockies and all these other great big mountain ranges. So keep this in mind. Yes, we're here to rejoice, but we're here to rejoice because we're going to have the opportunity of showing people the abundant life by obeying God, which today they don't have. They don't have. You read it in the paper time after time after time. There's one yesterday that caught my eye. The guy said I had a 7-figure salary and a this and a that, and the next thing, and my wife's just gone and left me, and I've got nothing. And you think, what a shame, the life completely trashed. Because there's no foundation, there's nothing solid. Nothing solid. And people will be given that back. You know, there used to be a sticker you got on your car, you know, a dog is for life, not for Christmas. Well, yeah, well, so's a wife, and she's forever. Yeah. So you're okay. Yeah. Well, that's the key. We're here to teach people to be healthy. And by that, to be prosperous. As Philip mentioned in that sermonette, if you get a piece of land and it's turning up 80 bushels of barley, and then you can work on and work on it and work on it and work on it and get the soil up to where it should be, it's going to be producing a lot more. It's worth a lot more. You've made a lot more. So people should be prosperous. They should be prosperous. And that's why we should be rejoicing, because that is what we are going to be a part of.